How would you describe the situation in Syria today?
Well, the situation is really both full of promise and somewhat a little dread as well. A promise because the barrier of fear has been broken. The young people of Syria, the young demographics, have decided to take over the initiative and to dictate the pace of change rather than wait for the old sort of establishment and the opposition or for the, you know, the government itself under Bashar al-Assad to reform. They decided to force the issue and take to the street and break the barrier of fear and make their demands known. And this is really the source of promise, and this is the source and the seed of victory to come, because that's inevitable. This is something that's going to happen. We have no doubt about that. It's a matter of when, not a matter of if. But the dread is that how much do you need to sacrifice? How long will it take? How much blood will be spilled because of the regime's entrenched authoritarian styles and tactics? So it's a very revolutionary situation, and as usual, revolutions, you have the promise, you have the dread, you have the concerns, the fears, and the anxieties, and the hopes, all of them sort of tangled in one jumble.
Does today's announcement of Syrian government resignation indicate that Assad's government is weakening?
Of course. I mean, it took us 2 weeks to achieve what years and years of sort of begging and petitioning did not accomplish. 2 weeks of protest toppled the government, and I think Assad staged this pro-regime demonstrations today in order to put a brave face on a concession that he is making. But what he doesn't understand is that this is not enough anyway, and regardless of how much concessions he is willing to make, the only concession that will satisfy us is his resignation, or he can stand trial. He is no longer wanted. The people have said it. They torn down his posters. They tore down a statue of his father. The symbols of power and legitimacy of the Assad dynasty are being scuffed at and torn in the streets in many cities. We have two cities in full rebellion right now, and they're staging it peacefully. The only violence coming is from the direction of the authorities, but it's not working, and the only sort of threats of sectarianism is coming from the authorities, and it's not working. The people insist on national unity, and they're taking their struggle to the street peacefully, and they are willing to pay the price, which is, you know, rains and hails of bullets aimed at them by the security officers, and, you know, already 150 people have died so far, not perhaps a lot by comparison to what happened in Libya or elsewhere, but still, for 2 weeks period, this is really a lot of people dying for just protesting peacefully for their rights.
But do you think that the Syrian opposition is strong enough to continue to reach the level of a regime change?
What you have to understand, the people who began this is not the opposition. They are young people, revolutionaries, activists on the streets. And so far, this movement is proven to be very contagious. And the current demonstrations that the regime has sort of orchestrated, you know, the pro-Assad, we know how they happen. They force students to take part. They force university students to take part. They force public sector employees to take part. But on the day after, a lot of anger takes place. And I think a lot of people are really sickened by being forced to do things like this. So expect that next Friday they will have a lot of the people who are forced to take part in the pro-regime demonstrations will take part in the anti-regime demonstrations, because that's how they really feel. So the more violence on part of the Assad and the more recourse to authoritarian tactics, the more people will join our cause. And yes, we are going to be getting organized. And yes, we are. We have the gumption. We have the the passion, and we are learning very quickly from the precedences of Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Bahrain and Libya. So we don't really need to look very far for inspiration anymore. And now that we have two cities in Daraa in the south and Latakia in the north having already established even local precedents for how things can get done, we don't really need to look far for inspiration. We have it in our midst, and now when we're learning fast. So if the people are producing an alternative, not only to the regime, but an alternative to the stale opposition. So now, if the opposition that have existed for a long time on the Syrian streets want to have some relevance, they have to play catch-up with the people.
But how do you see the U.S. reaction to the Syrian government using violent against peaceful protesters compared to the U.S. position in the past with Egypt and even Yemen?
In a sense, the Clinton's reaction in particular was a bit upsetting because she said the word reformer about the president. Today she calibrated her statements in a press conference and she said, look, I was actually quoting some people in Congress, not referring to my own opinion. A few days ago, I think Gates said something about how the presidents of Syria should look to the examples of Tunisia and Egypt and learn from that, and Libya and learn from that. So these were far more promising and positive remarks because they hinted at the possibility that the president should really learn that the international community would not just wait and watch the Assad slaughter their own people. But it's important to note that the Syrian people so far have not called on anyone from outside the country to intervene. When the people of Daraa were being slaughtered, they called upon their neighbors in neighboring cities, and they said, help us, Faza, Faza, Ya Horan, help us, O people of Horan, which is the historic name of the governorate of Daraa. And people came in droves to help, and people all over the country sort of rebelled to help, and all of them were chanting, we will sacrifice our life and soul, our blood and soul for you, Daraa. And so they are helping each other right now, the Syrian people. And as long as this is their desire, it's fine. The moment they begin to say we need help from the international community, it will become a legitimate thing for us on the outside, the dissident community outside, to go ahead and knock on the doors of the people at the State Department, the UN, Congress, wherever, in order to get international support. But for now, the Syrian people want to do it on their own. Yes, if there's going to be major bloodshed, and of course the Assad have a lot of weapons, and if the army didn't take a sort of a stand against the Assad in this regard, we will have to sort of look to the international community for help. But so far, that scenario has not played out.
But President Assad is promising a nice surprise in the coming couple of days that would please the Syrians, including lifting the emergency law. Would that calm the people, or what kind of reforms that you're looking for to calm the population and maybe continue the regime?
Well, I think we've seen what kind of reform he has in mind. I mean, he sort of, by arranging this demonstration and forcing people in this way, he is really playing a page out of the old book. So in other words, regardless of what he's going to say, he already lost the whatever chance at deceiving us he had because of his insistence on playing that sort of, and putting that show, that political farce that no one really buys in the country or even outside these days. So no matter how much he tries, how he plans to package the introduction of a new government or the idea of removing the state of emergency or whatever, that's not enough anymore. So long that he is in power, no one is going to stop the revolution. The only thing that can stop the revolution, the only good news he can have for us, is his departure.
But we didn't see the demonstrators in the cities of Syria asking for a regime change. They are asking for something else.
They are asking, look, if you listen to the cries, first of all, there were actually a few demonstrations that actually clear out, that came out and said the people want to topple the regime. Ash-Sha'b yurid isqat al-nizam. We've heard it in Daraya, we've heard it in Homs, we've heard it in Daraa, we've heard it in Latakia. There were demonstrators who clearly said it. Other demonstrators simply elaborated the word hurriya, hurriya, freedom, freedom, freedom. Other demonstrators sort of put a list of 9 demands saying, first of all, we want end to corruption and name and for the president cousin by name. We want free presidential elections, free parliamentary election, and end to the state of emergency, release of all political prisoners. When you go down the list, you realize this amount to regime change. In other words, no matter how they phrased it in the final analysis, their actions spoke louder than words when they defaced the posters of the president, destroyed the statue of Hafez al-Assad, and crying and changing a long time cry that the Mukhabarat used to, praise Bashar, which is God, Syria, Assad, and that's all, and made it God, Syria, freedom, and that's all. So they made it very clear by, in many ways, that their desire is to see the regime get toppled. And this is what we are trying to push.
Daraa is largely a Sunni community, mm-hmm. and the ruling government is mostly, or the president, dynasty is Alawi, which is a segment of the Shia Muslim. Is that telling us that the split among opposition is being avoided, and now we are having a united sort of opposition in Syria?
Indeed, look, first of all, the slogans also that were reiterated many times across Syria from the very beginning were about national unity. You know, one of the slogans was Sunnis and Alawites for national unity, together Arabs and Kurds. And in the mosque, in the Umayyad Mosque itself, when the first demo took place right inside the Umayyad Mosque, one of the demonstrators sort of raised a piece of paper saying no to tyranny, yes to freedom, and there is the cross and the crescent. So they tried, the protesters, in so many ways to send a clear message to the Syrian people that this is not a sectarian thing, that this is about national unity, and that Sunnis and Alawites and Arabs and Kurds and Muslims and Christians are in it together. Daraa is largely Sunni, but also Daraa, the first city to rebel, was a stronghold of the Ba'ath Party. Most of the people were members of the Ba'ath Party. Many people from Daraa were, you know, recruited in the Mukhabarat, in the state, in the army. They played a key role in this. And yet they are the first to rebel. Why? Because Bashar al-Assad changed the formula of caring about the power base of the Ba'ath Party. He betrayed his own party in his policies and his corruption. The rampant corruption in the circles of the Assad family, when they liberalized everything without caring about how that impacted the average Joe in the street and how that impacted the rural areas around Damascus and around major cities, and how that impacted districts farther away from Damascus, is the crime that they have committed against the people and against themselves. That's how they hurt themselves. Daraa was a power base. The vice president of Syria was from there. Many of the leaders in the Ba'ath Party were from Daraa, and yet they rebelled. So, and Latakia is another place that, where this full-scale rebellion has taken place, is also another power base for the regime. And yet, and there were Sunnis and Alawis, by the way, rebelling. And the only person who tried to play the sectarian card was the spokeswoman of the president. And the authorities brought people, smugglers, from the mountain areas to Latakia in order to have them shoot at demonstrators and provoke sort of sectarian violence. But the Sunnis and Alawites inside Turkey, inside Latakia itself, they had no problem with each other. There was no sectarian fight. And on the next day, there was a YouTube video. They established a square right there in the Slaybe neighborhood where the protest took place in Latakia. And they called for national unity, and they refuted the statements about sectarianism and terrorism and all of this, and they called all media that can make it to Latakia to come and see the real picture and come and see the real faces of the protesters, that they are not sectarian, that they have specific demands that they want to be met, and that they are not going to leave the streets until these demands are met. So there is no sectarianism involved here, and it's not about the Sunni Alawi thing, it's about the freedom thing.
But if we go back to the origin of what happened in Daraa, it was some young people spraying graffiti on the walls and got arrested, and people were asking for their release. How did that evolve to a full-blown uprising?
Of course, there's a background to that. This is, I mean, every revolution have a direct cause and have an indirect cause. The indirect cause has been, there's a story, a background story of corruption of the local governor, of the cousin of the president buying land and not paying the real price, market value of it, and confiscating land, and his businesses basically being established in areas and hurting that hurts other people. So these corrupt practices have been the subject of many complaints for several years now, and they've been ignored by all of the authorities, the governor, the head of the local security apparatus in Daraa, and so on. So that was the sort of the background. The people were getting impoverished. They have a lot of anger vis-a-vis the local authorities, and no one was listening to them. So when the spark of Sidi Bouzid in Tunisia was launched, when Bouazizi burnt himself, and when that freedom wave got started, many people in Syria were the young people, you know, in the early teens now, forget even about the late teens. They were teenagers, 12 and 13 and 14. They were dazzled. This was cool to them. So they took to the street and they began spraying on the walls, you know, down with Bashar al-Assad. And of course, when children think along these lines, you can feel that they are absorbing it from the neighborhood. They're absorbing it from their parents. They're absorbing it from the overall feel in the city vis-a-vis Bashar al-Assad. So they immediately began spraying that and expressing what people have in their mind and souls right there on the walls. Eventually, the authorities caught up with 15 of them, and they put them in prison. Now, Daraa is a clan-based society, so that caused a lot of anger because these were children in the final analysis. So the people demanded their release, and the sort of the governor stalled, and you know, as usual, you know, and even berated the family when he met with them. So the people were really angry. Meanwhile, the people in their late teens and early 20s all over Syria were communicating on Facebook and agreeing on tactics and dates for the revolution. At first, I was one of the people who said, we are not ready yet. Let's push it till the summer. And I even wrote an article about it in The Guardian. A lot of people thought that I am sort of against the revolution, but I was against the timing of too soon. Indeed, the date of February 5th, the first initial date, came and no one showed up. There was no readiness in the street. So they were back to the drawing board, and again, I was hoping that sometimes in the summer, you know, the revolution will take place, but a lot of people on Facebook decided March 15th. Eventually, it's really the decision came from inside. The young people who created the chat groups decided March the 15th. That's it. We don't want to wait for the Libyan example to get more complicated and people to get scared. So either now or, you know, never. So we agreed, and March 15th came. And lo and behold, a couple of demonstrations, small ones in Damascus, but in Daraa was a bigger demonstration. The authorities immediately began using violence. There were several people who got killed. Now that there is blood in the street, more people came out and the things started escalating until finally the people took over the square near Al-Omari Mosque in Old Daraa. And they held mini Tahrir type, events and began chanting about liberty and down with the regime and whatever. And there was a crackdown, and that crackdown led to a full-scale rebellion with over 100,000 people showing up, 50,000 in Daraa city itself, 50,000 in neighboring towns, and the entire country basically on last Friday came to the aid of Daraa by demonstrating themselves and also making a huge protest, and the fire caught on, you know, the fire of a revolution.
So if Assad goes the way that Mubarak and Ben Ali went and stepping down, what would be the impact for Syria's allies like Hezbollah, like Iran, like Hamas? Are they going to lose?
If you want to think about it, about ultimate, who's going to ultimately lose and ultimately win, I think there will be no ultimate loser and winner. In the game of politics, on the level of Iran and Hezbollah and Lebanon, there's always some maneuverability. These are not sort of like foreign entities. They have an organic presence, and they have certain interests, and they represent their own, they represent forces on the ground. So they are not going to disappear. What's going to happen, however, is that the entire political formula will have to change. Syria's role is not going to be that of an enabler to the policies of Iran and Hezbollah and others. We are going to look to our own national interests and look and see whether our national interest is served by this kind of a cause that put us always at odds with the rest of the world. I think most of the Syrian people want to see development, want to see living standards improve, want to see better relationship with all of our neighbors, want to see peace reign, and they really want to see also an end, if you want to talk about the Palestinian cause, to the Palestinian cause in a just way. But they don't want to see war. They don't want to see conflict. So that concept of, the resistance rhetoric and formula will have to be amended and changed into a more proactive resistance rather than the violent type resistance, into the kind of resistance that actually allows for societies to be built, not only for societies to be held hostage and captive by ruling elites and at the whim of the ruling elites. There will be a large debate about these issues, and I think everybody is interested in having everyone in Syria debate the issues and not have anyone, any figure, any force impose a decision that's already fabricated and according to the vision of one small group here or there and then impose it on the rest of the people. These issues will be debated, and believe me, the debate, moderate tones, moderate radicalism, moderate expectations, and will allow people the chance to make a more rational decisions in due course of time on all of these important issues of regional security.
But so far, excuse me, so far Saudi Arabia is backing the regime in Syria, while we can expect Saudi Arabia to be hoping that a new regime in Syria would be more anti-Iran. Would that happen down the road?
you know, the Saudis at this stage, I think they may not be absorbing the full scale of how organic this protest revolution is. They might be sort of trying to hope to get concessions from Assad by backing him now, for later. There is a problem of leadership, I think, in the Saudi camp, because they're also caught up in their own problems and fears, and I don't know exactly who's in charge anymore in Saudi. But be that as it may, I think our purpose as Syrians is not to interfere in Saudi policies and not to want them to interfere in our politics. I think the protesters, if they continue protesting, the message will be received by the entire regional community that this is not going to go away. And the best thing to do is to err on the side of protesters. The wrong side of history is already too crowded. And if the Saudis and others want to join it, they will find themselves to be really struggling for breath. It's about time for the region's leaders to think about getting to the right side of history and stand with their own people in the region. I hope they realize that in due course of time, and I hope the Saudi intellectuals who are making demands right now for their own sort of reform in the kingdom will get their way. Meanwhile, we have to focus on our own scenarios in Syria, and I'm sure that as the protests go on and up the ante, regional expectations and calculations and international expectations and calculations will be changed, and they will come to see it our way.
Amar, you have been busy meeting Congress people and discussing the situation in Syria. What kind of feedback and response you are getting, positive, negative?
So far, actually, we're getting very positive. I think the idea of the image of Bashar as a reformer, to which Mrs. Clinton referred, is actually changing. You know, so things change on a dime sometimes in Congress. The reality of revolution is really making a lot of people in Congress sort of take a moment to think. Even when John Kerry a few weeks ago said a positive statement about Assad, I think he said them basically because the full impact of the revolution and how serious it is hasn't yet hit home. But now that it has, I think a lot of people, including Kerry himself, would begin to look and say, hey, you know, we need to be on the right side of history, and we need to sort of re-examine our entire relationship and image of that man, Bashar al-Assad, and his regime, and whether they are indeed that important to our interests or not. So I think right now we are going through a moment where a lot of people are going to rechart America's vision for its role in the Middle East, and I really believe that neither this administration nor the Congress, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, want to be caught again on the wrong side of history. So if the protests go on, and they will go on, I think a lot of support will be coming from all different quarters in the world: Congress, White House, UNHCR, UN Security Council, European Union. Everybody will be on our side. All we need to do right now is keep growing and keep the protest alive and moving and growing and engulfing more and more Syrian cities.
But did you detect any fear among pro-Israeli Congress people that think that Syria has a very pivotal role to play in the Middle East peace, and if we allow Syria to get into chaotic situation, that would impact negatively Israel? Did you detect such a feeling among some of them?
There was some concerns, but a couple of weeks ago, perhaps, when all of this was beginning. But now I realize that they are looking also at the Egyptian example and once again at the Tunisian example, and they're realizing the streets are not really as radical as they thought them to be. Yes, there's going to be some changes in the dynamics, and Islamists might be getting more leeway here and there, but it's not sort of like an Iranian revolution. It's not that the radical Islamists are going to come and take over and sort of create havoc for everybody. It's a dialogue. They discovered that this whole issue is going to be something of a dialogue and of a give and take, and that there is something about the open political process that would be moderating even radical Islamists. Because they are not the majority in the final analysis, they have to play the political game. And they have to find ways to deal with the other segments of society. And this is exactly what's going to happen in Syria. We are even a more diverse society than Egypt, and as such, there are a lot of forces within Syrian societies that will help contain whatever more radical sort of Islamist sentiments out there. So the reality is, in the case of Syria in particular, fears of an Islamist takeover are really very minimal, and many people now in Congress are beginning to accept that, because for the first time, I think, they are getting educated by their staffers and by us, during our meeting on the real realities, ethnic realities and demographic realities of Syria, and how basically it's not about Sunnis versus Alawites. It's actually a very complicated, diverse picture. There are clans, there are tribes, there are urban classes, there are, you know, rich and poor and educated classes who are very westernized. And you know, so they are beginning to realize that this is not, you know, that the outcome of revolution is definitely not going to be a radical government in charge, and that there will be a lot of pragmatism involved in the political process.
But tell us, what do you think of the influence of the Ba'ath Party, who has been influencing life in Syria for over 50 years, and who will be replacing President Assad, another Ba'athist leader, and how would that impact the basic freedoms like freedom of expression?
Basically, of course, we're not hoping for another Ba'ath takeover. What we are hoping for is an open political process whereby different parties compete on an equal footing, and we're looking for towards a new constitution. For that, we need a transitional period. A transitional council needs to be established, and this is what a lot of people in the opposition are working on right now, and I would imagine it won't take us any more than a few more days to finalize something along these lines. And it's only going to be transitional, so it's not going to be the government to be. It's going to be the transitional government that might be in charge for a few months. But after that, it's going to be left to the people to elect leaders, to select their own representative, to vote for a constitution. So all of these processes really are being worked out, and there is a project that's been discussed quietly between different opposition groups inside and outside the country that will be sort of made available to everybody to also look at and consider. This is going to be only a working arrangement until, of course, we have control in the country, and the people will be able to then say and vote according to their own wishes and desires. A transitional period will allow many members of the ancien regime to play a role. If they took an initiative right now, seized the moment, and began disassociating themselves from the Assad family and their clan and began joining the rank of the revolutionaries. So at one point, the more people from the old regime come and join us to establish something new, the faster the process will be, and the greater the chances of the transitional period being sort of smoother and shorter.
Judging from the experiences of Tunisia and Egypt, what makes it happen was the role of the army. In case of the Syrian army, what kind of role the Syrian army would play into the uprising, support it or suppress it, like what's happening in Libya now?
Now, this is really a very good question, because the Syrian army is also another professional army. We have around 240,000, 250,000 people in the army. But the structure of the army is very diverse. It's definitely not only Sunnis, it's Alawites and Sunnis and Christians and Druze, and everybody is represented there, and Arabs and Kurds, everybody is represented. But the president and his brother trust only the Republican Guard, which number around 10,000 to 12,000, and the 4th Division, which number around 20,000. Both are under the leadership of Maher al-Assad, and both have been involved in the crackdowns in Daraa and Latakia. The rest of the army, even though there were divisions closer to Daraa than Maher al-Assad's own sort of 4th Division, they were not called on to interfere, because many of them are actually from Daraa. And many of them are, their leadership is not really trusted by the Assad regime. The best arms and the favors and the cars and the salaries are given to the 4th Division and the Republican Guard. The others are treated as if, you know, very badly. So that actually creates a ground for dissension within the army ranks. And I think when push comes to shove, there is a great possibility that some people in the army will dissent. They will refuse to fire on their own people if ordered to, and they might be encouraged, if there was a bloody crackdown, to actually take a stand against it. So you can see from Assad's own policy, therefore, that they are not dealing with the army in a trusting way. They are focusing only on the part of the army that they control. That itself is very telling, and that itself opens the door to a lot of people in the army to actually begin also thinking about their options. So as time wears on and as the revolution continues, I think we might see defections and we might see the possibility of the army taking a stand with the people. So that's an open question, it remains to be seen how, of course, this whole thing is going to play out. But there is a Gaddafi element here in the sense that Gaddafi has neglected his army, so many divisions rebelled against him in the final analysis, and he had to rely on mercenaries. That scenario is open in Syria as well.
Mercenaries?
Mercenaries is also a possibility. At least right now, people are afraid of it. In Daraa, for instance, the people chanted slogans against Hezbollah and Iran because there were always rumors, even before this entire revolution began, that the Bashar would rely on Iran and Hezbollah, to support him and on their element. I think they're rumors. I really don't believe there are any members of the Iranian Guard or the Hezbollah sort of playing a role. But I also know that there is always a lot of coordination and exchange of expertise. Riot gear, for instance, Syrians don't have riot gear, Syrian police, but they are importing them from Iran. They're also importing the kind of weapons that can be used in this kind of conflict, and Turkey has just, in fact, stopped two airplanes. One of them was coming from Iran to Syria. One of them did have weapons, and the Turkish press published it. I mean, this is not a secret. So the reality is then there is that possibility happening. And that's one of those scary scenarios that I'm hoping, and everybody in Syria is hoping, will not play out, and that a decision by the army to side with the people will probably prevent the scenario from even showing up. And Turkey's role in trying to stop arms flow from Iran, I think, is also very encouraging, because they don't seem to be willing to stand by and watch a massacre take place in Syria. And as you know, there was Erdogan himself said that he advised Bashar al-Assad to reform and to adopt reform and not to sort of use violence against his people. So Turkey is erring, it seems, if you want to call it error. Turkey is siding one way or another with democracy in Syria and with the protesters, at least passively at this stage. So that's encouraging, and this is at least one neighbor who seems to be concerned about Syria making a smooth transition towards democracy.
My final question would be about your perception of the coming scenario. The president will be giving a speech in a couple of days. Would that be a second breath that will make the regime have a second life, or it's a done deal that the revolution is wiping out the regime?
I think it's a done deal. To be honest with you, that revolution is going to continue because the demands, have been upped to a certain point, and because the crimes that have been committed, I mean, the bloodshed that took place in Daraa and Latakia was completely unjustified. The lies that have been told by the spokespeople of the regime, the demo that took place earlier today, in support of, quote unquote, in support of the regime, all of these things really makes the president completely lose credibility. So what is he going to say when he allowed these things to happen up until now? Is he going to say that can remove and help him regain legitimacy other than saying goodbye, I'm sorry? I mean, this is definitely not something that's I don't really envision any scenario in which he can be accepted. So right now, I think what we are looking towards, we are not even waiting for him to speak anymore. I mean, he can speak, he doesn't speak, who cares? In a sense, we are writing him off. And the revolution is going to continue, and we believe that this is a chance that has been bought dearly for us. The young people sacrificed their lives, and if we give Assad a second chance that he definitely does not deserve, we'll be betraying the martyrs who fell. So I don't really think that this is a possibility that Bashar Assad can survive this, or that we can accept anything he has to say after he lost his trust completely. Had he made any of the concessions that he made
a year ago,
that would have been a different story altogether. But to make them now, and now we feel our power. I mean, in 2 weeks, we brought down a government. So now that we felt our power, do you really think that we are going to just to say, oh, just because he said some good words and smiled, you know, and made some vague reform of promises that he can forget about later, that we're going to be fooled? No way. We understand this regime right now. They give with the right hand, they take with the left, and everything stays the same. And in fact, it gets even worse as far as basic rights are concerned. No more. No more caught up in this web of lies and deceit. We want out, and the only way we can get out of the situation is to remove the reasons for its existence. And these reasons are encapsulated in people like Bashar al-Assad and Maher al-Assad. One of the videos, by the way, that were released recently, they were not about the demonstrations now or the protests now. They were about a massacre that took place in the prison called Sednaya in 2008 in July. In 2008 in July, the political prisoners in Sednaya rioted to protest the living conditions, to protest the abuse that they were receiving at the hands of the jail keepers. And they managed to take control of the prison for a few days. Bashar al-Assad at the time ordered his brother to crack down with the army and sort of liberate, quote-unquote, the prison. And he gave that order and went to Paris, where he was celebrated by Sarkozy, you know, in the Mediterranean summit that took place at the time. And that was the first trip he made on this level to a Western country after a long period of isolation. So he celebrated his coming out of isolation party by cracking down on the political prisoners in Sednaya. Now, the video that we have is of Maher al-Assad standing between the corpses of the dead in civvies, very cool, very quiet, sort of taking a look and looking at his cell phone. As you can hear the sort of the cries of the people all around him. Very gruesome video, very gruesome video. And frankly, even if the video is somehow not real, but we know who is responsible. And anyway, everybody who saw it knows that this is Maher al-Assad. But let's put that assumption, that this is not real. But it shows you that people know who's responsible anyway, who for committing that massacre. We cannot forgive something like that. We cannot forgive the killing of prisoners, the killing of children, the theft of the fortune of the country, the humiliation that you have to suffer daily on the hand of the security apparatus. This is not something we can forget and say, oh, let's give you another chance. No, we'll give the homeland another chance. We will give people who are willing to break from the regime and side with the people another chance. But we are not going to give the criminals who perpetrated these crimes and who insist on holding on to power for dear life another chance. These people deserve to be kicked out. Bashar's choices were, he can go ahead and retire to a nice sort of luxurious villa or a palace in London, or spend the rest of his life in a prison cell in Sednaya itself. But if he continues on deferring that, he may not have that option. He may have that one option, you know, of just staying in Sednaya and after being tried in a court of law for his crimes. He doesn't, I think, understand that this is a possibility. But now we know it's actually a certainty.
Thank you very much, Omar.